Kahan International wrote in this regard, "It is an undeniable fact that the US, Britain, France, and the illegal Zionist entity are the real aggressors of the 8-year war against the people of Yemen, launched by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The lethal weapons supplied to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi by these merchants of death have so far killed over 220,000 men, women, and children, besides destroying the infrastructure of the Arab world's most impoverished country. Conscientious observers and bodies in the West have strongly protested to their regimes for the human catastrophe their warmongering policies have inflicted on a whole nation. For instance, Oxfam charity has charged the British regime of prolonging the war in Yemen by allowing, among other sophisticated weapons, the export of air-to-air refueling equipment used by Saudi Air Force to conduct indiscriminate bombing of civilian targets in Yemen." It revealed in January that weapons supplied by the UK and US to the Saudi-led coalition in war-torn Yemen killed at least 839 civilians and wounded 1,775 others in just over a year. Imagine the death toll of the past 8 years as a result of the weapons supplied by these purveyors of international terrorism. Weapons from Britain that flow unchecked into the arsenal of Saudi Arabia for use in Yemen included Pave-guided bombs, Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, all of which the regime in London admits have been deployed in the conflict in Yemen. According to Press TV, an Oxfam report which analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021 shows at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircraft used in the attacks, over half of which were British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The fatalities were due to artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, roadside bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Pave bombs, as well as Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians, as stated by the International Development Committee of the UK. Given that the UK has a long history of defense exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, and considering the evidence, it seems inevitable that any violations of international humanitarian and human rights law by the coalition have involved armaments supplied from the UK. These arms have also been used by Saudi-led coalition to bomb health facilities on 19 separate instances, which constitutes war crimes. Oxfam's policy advisor Martin Butcher called on the UK government to immediately cease its arms sales to the Saudis, He also pointed out the UK hypocrisy in sanctioning Russia while turning a blind eye to the blatant war crimes of Saudi Arabia coalition in Yemen. Bucher also highlighted the fact that the UK government still continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, being its second biggest arms supplier, which will inevitably be used in the war against Yemen. He revealed that the UK government have not only been arming Saudi Arabia, but have also been very reluctant to use their position on the United Nations Security Council to push for peace. Saudi Arabia is the biggest importer of arms in the world, second only to a country with 40 times the population of KSA. In the year 2020 alone, the kingdom imported nearly $1 billion worth of arms, the majority of which came from the US. However, this does not stop the US from parroting a tired narrative of pushing for peace in Yemen, when in reality they even hesitate to call it a war. This is apparent by Biden's initial pledges to end the war during his presidential campaign while continually supplying arms to the kingdom to this very day. However, the weapons fragments, emblazoned with the US and UK branding, paint a starkly different picture. The six-month United Nations-sponsored truce, which was supposed to be the grounds for longer-standing solutions, was also very quickly and repeatedly violated by Saudi Arabia. Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Some 30 million people across the U.S. are seeing a portion of their federal food assistance taken away. Some households could lose hundreds of dollars each month, even as families continue to face increased food prices, and analysts warn the cuts will bring millions to a hunger cliff. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, March 1st, that is Wednesday, around 30 million people across the United States will have their families' food assistance slashed, despite high prices and experts warning about a hunger cliff. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, benefits were initially increased at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. Although Republicans in 18 states had already ended the emergency allotments, households in other 32 states, along with Washington, D.C., Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, have continued to receive them. However, the increased SNAP benefits are set to end because of omnibus spending package from December. Federal lawmakers traded the temporary pandemic-era boost for a permanent program to feed children in the summer. "We're really going to struggle," Dina Hardy, a mother of two in Marshfield, Wisconsin, told ABC News, adding, "We are going to have to end up going back to cheaper items like noodles and processed stuff because the meat, the dairy, fruits, and veggies, it's expensive. I don't think the cuts could have happened at a worse time," added Hardy, whose family relies on a fixed income and will see their benefits drop from $960 to $200 per month. When the extra payments began, food prices were nowhere near where they are now. As Tracy Roof, an associate professor of political science at the University of Richmond, recently wrote for The Conversation, many advocates for a stronger safety net say SNAP benefits are too low to meet the needs of low-income people. They are warning of a looming hunger cliff, meaning a sharp increase in the number of people who don't get enough nutritious food to eat in March 2023 when the extra help ends. At that point, the lowest income families will lose $95 in benefits a month. But some SNAP participants, such as many elderly and disabled people who live alone and on fixed incomes and who only qualify for the minimum amount of help, will see their benefits plummet from $281 to $23 a month. A trio of Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP experts, pointed out earlier this month that a study estimated that EAs kept 4.2 million people above the poverty line in the past quarter of 2021, reducing poverty by 10% and child poverty by 14% in states with EAs at the time. The estimated reduction in poverty rates due to EAs was the highest for Black and Latino people. According to Axios, CBPP President Sharon Parrott warned the cuts will allow very high levels of poverty to remain in the country. Noting the outlet's report, Public Citizen President Robert Weisman declared that a decent society would not let this happen, expanded the SNAP benefits, and will push 32 million Americans off a hunger cliff. The looming cuts are a reminder that poverty is a policy choice in this country. Elizabeth Lower Bosch, Deputy Executive Director for the Center for Law and Social Policy, told Axios, "For a while, we decided we were going to make a different policy choice." Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, agreed and demanded action by federal lawmakers. "Tomorrow, SNAP benefits will drop back to pre-pandemic levels," she tweeted, adding, "That means $171 less each month for 520,000 Washington families struggling to make ends meet, ending these increased benefits will cause more food insecurity and poverty. Jayapal added, "It's unacceptable. Poverty and hunger are policy choices. It's time we step up and do more." According to Guardian, the number of U.S. children in food poverty nearly doubles in a year to 4 million. The number of these children in food poverty has nearly doubled in the last year to almost 4 million, new data shows, ramping up pressure on the government to expand the provision of free school meals to struggling families. According to the Food Foundation think tank, 1 in 5, about 22% of households, reported skipping meals, going hungry or not eating for a whole day in January, up from 12% at the equivalent point in 2022.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It was reported as a positive trip by the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi to Iran's capital, Tehran. Grossi hailed relations between Iran and the IAEA as positive after meeting with Iran's atomic chief Islami and Iran's president Ebrahim Raisi. But underlying this trip, IAEA inspectors had reported Iran had enriched uranium close to 84%, which Iran had to then clarify. Why are there such reports which then require Iran to have to defend its stance? And why did Grossi, when asked whether the IAEA is a political tool at the hands of a few, would deny this to be the case? Just a couple of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guest. Farshid Baghariyan is a political analyst who joins us from Karaj. Also joining us is Don Dabar, who's an activist and commentator, joining us from Ossining in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Farshid Baghariyan, first over to you. We're looking at what was this trip that took 2 days in duration, of which it was, I don't want to use the word hailed, but it was widely reported to be very positive in terms of the cooperation, and some even called an agreement between the IAEA and Iran. But why should this be such a positive thing when you take a look at all the different hardships that Iran has endured based on giving itself that cooperation spirit and then not getting what it should have gotten in return?
Thank you very much. I believe that the
International Atomic Agency took before took the Iranian cooperation as a granted, because Iran, during this talk and deal with Iran for the nuclear talks from 2015 till now, during this time, always Iranian did their duty. But the Western Europe, the Western powers, especially the United States, they didn't act as a friendly act to us. So I just see in some days before, Mr. Putin announced that he withdraw from the START 1 nuclear agreement with the United States. This is what the main reason of the trip of Mr. Grossi to Tehran, because the escalation of the nuclear hazard or nuclear war all around the world, it make them to think about again for Iran, because the particle they found as a 84% of enrichment is what merely was the particle, not the activity. And right now the report should be friendly, as they had a common briefing, press briefing, I think, and they told that the enrichment was 60%, and this is acceptable for us. It was acceptable before this trip, and right now they need some guarantee from Iran for not enrich anymore, or maybe help Russia, because Russia is merging for a new attack on the spring to the Ukraine, and the escalation of the nuclear hazard maybe the spread over all around the world. This is the fact that they are approaching more friendly to Iran this time. This is the fact, not anything else, because Mr. Ned Price and Blinken speeches regarding, and the their opinion was not friendly, and they told that we are waiting for the report from the Mr. Grossi, and Mr. Grossi is not the decision maker for the West, and just not bringing any he's not bringing any message from West to us. Just Mr. Grossi is take them that Iran did his duty, and Iran is giving the guarantee to not support any nuclear, nuclear, how can I explain, nuclear hazard for the spread over the world. That is the fact that, okay, Mr. Grossi was here. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Don DeBar, I guess they're talked about 60% enrichment. I have so many questions to ask, but just on that particular note there, there was a press conference that Grossi had in Vienna just about an hour ago. And this is really interesting. He says on the 60%, the Iranians, don't need to tell us why they reached 60%. What's important, we have the necessary ability to inspect. Isn't that kind of an odd statement to come from the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi?
It is an odd statement if you expect essentially that that the architecture of international relations is an architecture of honest brokerage. But of course it's not. It's in the real world. The United States and the Soviet Union were the principal engines of the IAEA. Eisenhower is credited with being his brainchild in 1957, but the United States didn't ratify the treaty and put it into effect as against the U.S. until 1967. The organization is centered in Vienna. That's the heart of NATO, basically. And it has been like the other instruments of international architecture based in Western Europe, an instrument of colonial control of much of the rest of the world. Look at the International Court of Justice and the other, the Hague judicial structures in general, which for some reason seem to prefer to indict African leaders over any other, potential defendants. The objective picture, going on right now is the United States is attempting to isolate each of its enemies between Russia, China, Iran in particular, and also South Africa and others that are beginning to see perhaps the objective requirement of some sort of military cooperation in the face of, an assault from the U.S. and NATO against all of them at once. There are the claims that Iran is sending drones and setting up manufacturing facilities for drones in Russia. There's the claim that China is considering manufacturing weapons for Russia, threats from the United States and all of that. This is the context in which Grossi holds his press conference. Remarkable, actually, is the fact that he didn't claim to find a nuclear suitcase when he was in Tehran and seek to have the U.S. invade and get rid of the weapons of mass destruction, because that is the pressure certainly coming from Washington at the moment.
Professor Balkhanian, taking a look at what question was asked by our Press TV correspondent to Rafael Grossi on the fact that whether the IAEA has been politicized in terms of the way information is given out or that it's being used as a political tool, and in terms of just overall vis-a-vis Iran, how it's given out ambiguous statements. The response by Grossi was, I think any attack, any military attack on a nuclear facility is outlaw, is out of the normative structures that we will all abide by. And he wouldn't even acknowledge that Iran's nuclear facility was actually attacked by Israel on more than one occasion. I mean, this was this is Rafael Grossi of the past. I'm not too sure what type of transformation he's gone through from then since now when it comes to Israel. Of course, we need to also mention that he went to Israel before there was a resolution leveled against Iran through the Board of Governors in the past. Why is he playing that posturing when asked that question?
I believe that, first of all, thank to our friend, fully agree with what he said. The fact is, Iran is right now, we have an expression in political science that means that sitting on the fence. Iran right now is sitting on the fence, and Iran can be declined to the right or the left. And that is the fact. Right now, they are. It's terrifying the world. I mean, the nuclear talk is right now terrifying the world. Because we can decline to the third, World War III, and maybe we can decline to the position that may push the world to the peace talk. This is the fact that right now, as you see, one or two days before it was a news that in the media that Russia is trying to reach to the Persian Gulf or the Oman Sea, and they can consider that Russia is spreading its power to the whole, region. Regarding the Israel, and holding this point right now, regarding the Israel has a very vulnerable size, and Israel is not powerful. Despite of Iron Dome, and Israel is not a safe place for the Israeli people. And any conflict with Iran through drones, through missiles, or any kind of the war machine, it would be very hazardous for the region, especially for the Israeli regime. So right now, they are trying to push Iran down from the fence to the exact point or exact site that they want right now. And I want to repeat that Mr. Grossi is not the policymaker guy or the player. Just he sent his report, and remember that the before the September, after the September 11th, then they attacked Iraq, and they after that, because they found some facilities and some site that they are producing chemical and biological and maybe a nuclear weapon, and after that they said that the FBI report was false. Mm-hmm. Right now, Iran is not giving them any permission to give the false report. And this is the fact that Mr. Grossi was here in Iran.
All right. Don DeBar, as this news is spreading, because it's very fresh off the press, especially given this press conference that Rafael Grossi had in Vienna, a very simple question that comes out of this is, why should Iran trust, I'm not going to say the agency, but the other actors, in particular the U.S., when it comes to anything that has to deal with Iran's civilian nuclear file? I mean, why should there be optimism here, which Grossi is sending this message of optimism? Put that into context for us, if you can.
Yeah, there's a number of ways to do that. Very first is there is already an agreement that was negotiated over a period of years with an awful lot of pressure from the United States, an awful lot of determination from Iran to protect its sovereignty, a participation of many others. Agreement was signed, executed, implemented, except for the part where Iran was supposed to get sanctions relief. That never really happened. Trump gets elected. He was campaigning against the agreement, and he abrogated what little participation the U.S. had done up to that point. And Biden ran against that, saying that Trump, you know, was making trouble where there was no need for trouble and that he shouldn't have withdrawn from the agreement. And now we're 2 years into Biden's administration and we still are here playing this game instead of starting, you know, where we were at on January 20th, 2017. That's the aspect with respect to the U.S. In 2014 and 2015, the United States, some 50 years after, almost 50 years after the execution of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which calls for the sunsetting of all nuclear weapons within a reasonable period of time, announces, in fact, it's going to spend $1 trillion to renew its nuclear arsenal. And I know that Mr. Grossi was not the head of the IAEA at the time, but I don't see any statement right now demanding that the United States cease and desist from that. Finally, in the context of the war in Ukraine, the nuclear doctrine of Russia was spelled out very simply, which is, number one, we will only use nuclear weapons if we are attacked with nuclear weapons or if the very survival of our state is threatened. And the U.S. response to that was to announce that they intended to take down the Russian state. If I were the head of the IAEA, I would then condemn the United States, first of all, for making this statement, and then tell them you have to do everything to back out of this condition so you don't provoke a nuclear war. And I don't see any of that happening. I see them nickel and diming Iran, impugning its integrity and sovereignty, and frankly, shilling for Israel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, so since both have mentioned Ukraine in this context, in terms of Iran, Farshid Bagherian, are we looking at the fact that instead of anybody pinning their hopes on something coming out of all the positive, from what it appears to be positive news coming from Grossi, that this is just so Grossi, through the IAEA, which is one of the UN's organization, which the U.S. provides at least almost a quarter of its budget, that they just want to have some kind of watch over Iran's civilian nuclear program, but they're not going to give any type of room for Iran because they believe that Iran, which Iran has denied, is providing Russia with these, for example, drones.
I believe that the watchdogs group prior to the trip of Mr. Grossi was in Iran and they inspected everything. And so he was, how can I explain? It was a political show only, merely, and nothing else. But the friendly and positively report has not made sense for Iran, first of all, because we are facing another decision making. For example, right now the Congress and the Senate of the United States is not giving power to the Mr. Biden administration, Mr. Biden himself, for example, to sign any new agreement with Iran, and they have to pass it because the legitimacy of this the agreement would be passed from the Congress. and they're very blockage and obstacle for Iran, for the any agreement, new agreement for Iran. But as I'm going to repeat again, the fact is we are approaching a new world war, maybe hazard, because the Mr. Gerasimov is right now is the head of the operation of the new spring attack to Ukraine. And the Gerasimov doctrine itself contains the using of the nuclear power. And that is the fact that the world is right now is being terrified. And right and in this position, they want to make Iran silence, to not cooperate with Russia as a strategic, tie.
Well, when you say this cooperation, that's a good point. We're kind of straying a little bit away from the subject here. But, Don DeBar, this cooperation between Iran and Russia is alarming the White House, and it is definitely alarming Israel. Our guest there says perhaps that they, the U.S. and Israel, will be looking at this from the top down in terms of them wanting to do things that would restrict this relationship, maybe. But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe they are noticing that this, to them, spells danger for whatever reasons they think that it would, and that they need to somewhat play catch-up in a sense. And so, therefore, they need to make sure that things get done. And Iran's civilian nuclear program is one way to at least have some kind of footing inside the Islamic Republic.
Yeah. It's leverage. That's exactly what it is. Look, you know, they do sanctions for the same reason. The purpose of sanctions, for example, and I'll point out that both Iran and Russia are the subject of massive sanctions from the U.S. and the EU. The purpose of that is to immiserate the population in the countries in the hope that it will create political unrest and the government will fall or be compromised or in a position where it will negotiate from a position of weakness. And the negotiations are high-pressure negotiations, in essence, for concessions to the Western corporations, in the case both of Russia and Iran, primarily of petrochemicals, petroleum, oil, et cetera, at prices favorable to the West, including ownership, which they're not shy about claiming. So the United States, which has dropped $100 billion worth of weaponry and other material aid for a war that's about 13 months old now, active shooting war in Ukraine, is telling Russia and Iran and China that they cannot, of course, have any sort of military aid from one to the other in the face of a major military threat and some 400 military bases facing those three countries under conditions of sanction, under conditions of continuous military provocation, as you pointed out, under conditions where the nuclear facilities are attacked militarily by the U.S. agent in the area, Israel. And so, you know, there is some pushback, but unfortunately for Russia and Iran and China, their sanity prevents them from responding in kind, because this escalates into a global war that serves no one's purposes. But the IAEA should be sitting in, I was going to say Jerusalem, but really Tel Aviv, the capital of the so-called State of Israel, and asking about the 300-plus warheads that exist there illegally, and you know, the fact that they may or may not, Israel's state may or may not be a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty means nothing, because if Iran withdrew from the treaty today, it certainly wouldn't mitigate what the U.S. would want to do to Iran under a claim that it has some sort of nuclear weapons. And no one's claiming Iran has anything near the capacity to produce an arsenal like the one that Israel has installed. And it's Iran that's the subject of sanctions and the subject of this, and not Israel.
That's a great point, Fashi Bagheriam. When you take a look at the different threats that have come, even as recent as just days ago practically, when he had a top U.S. Defense Department official say that Iran could make enough material for one nuclear bomb in 12 days. You had the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which has time and again, for practically more than a decade, maybe even longer, make those claims against Iran. Yet you have the nuclear, the U.S. nuclear posture review in 2022 saying there is no evidence that the Iranian government is pursuing a nuclear weapon. Quote, Iran does not today possess a nuclear weapon, and we currently believe it is not pursuing one. That's the Pentagon's authoritative report. You have somebody from the Pentagon saying Iran is going to develop one in 12 days, but the Pentagon report says, no, it does not possess a nuclear weapon, and it's not pursuing one. What do you make of the threats that Farshid Baghirian?
Israeli regime is right, is nowadays is suffering from the turmoil, domestic turmoil, and I think that Mr. Netanyahu cannot get rid of this turmoil right now. And they are some kind of credit. They are making a credit for the foreign policy to put it in the domestic policy. And Mr. We cannot base, making any there doesn't make sense. The talk with Mr. Netanyahu and all he said about because the line that the Pentagon is said, or maybe the authorities of the United States say that they indeed make in 12 days Iran can make the nuclear a weapon, is the all the words that they are using is derived from the Mr. Netanyahu administration. But the fact is Iran, after 84% enrichment, they found some particles right now, they get it down to 60%. And what happened to 12 days? And if you make a calculation, 12 days is right now make to, maybe set back to 12 months. Iran is not making any nuclear weapon. And they know this, is the ideological context. And this is, they know it very well. But they are, I'm trying to repeat my sentence that they have fear regarding the strategic ties with Russia. And they have fear that maybe Russia can bring some warhead from its own motherland to Iran and put it in some military bases. This is the fact that they are sending the watchdogs to Iran and before the trip of Mr. Gerusi. And the watchdogs is always all the time in the year.
Okay, let me jump in and give Don DeBar, I'm sorry, 30 seconds is the last question. Yeah. Do you agree with our guest there, what he just said? Because that's a pretty important point.
Yeah, I'll tell you what also is an important point is the fact that's exactly what the U.S. does with the NATO countries. You know, not Poland and Finland and whoever else that ends up in NATO on the front lines. They're not supposed to have nuclear weapons by treaty. All they right. are signatories to the non-proliferation treaty. But the United States bases nuclear weapons in those countries and says it's not those countries, it's us, and we're allowed.
Thank you. Don DeBar, activist and commentator from Masaning. Farshid Baghirian, thank you, political analyst from Karaj.
Good night.
And we'd like to thank you for watching this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatway and the team. It's goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Limelight.
Hidden violence by police forces in Western countries is far more than developing countries, including those in West Asia and even Africa. This may be related to the complexity of the nature of crime and the definition of criminal behavior, as well as the police's view of these countries to humans as useful creatures for industrial society. One of the countries in which police commit lots of violence is Britain. In recent years, there has been many news about it. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, in every community, the police are considered to be the symbol of peace and security. There are few societies in which citizens are afraid of seeing the police, and this is rooted in the name of the police, which comes from the Greek word police, which means city and civility. A police officer is actually a law enforcement officer, but in the modern world, especially in recent years, some policemen's behavior towards citizens has been very harsh, in violation of basic human rights. One of the countries in which police commit lots of violence is Britain. The name of the British police today is associated with violence, rape, and abuse. With a simple search on the internet, you can find the most harrowing stories of British police that look more like crime books. Some instances of police violence are organized and some others are a result of the spirit of violence among the Metropolitan Police Forces. Today in England, a Metropolitan Police officer, even if he is off duty, allows himself to handcuff a young girl for not complying with the restrictions of Corona, put her in his car, rape her, and kill her. That girl was none other than Sarah Everard, who was killed in March 2021, and the police officer was none other than Wayne Cousins. Another case in this regard is the case of David Carrick. He is a serving officer in London's Metropolitan Police, who has admitted to 49 offences, including 24 counts of rape over an 18-year period. David Carrick appeared at Southwark Crown Court in the British capital on January 16, 2022, to plead guilty for 4 counts of rape, false imprisonment, and indecent assault relating to a 40-year-old woman in 2003. The UK's PA Media News Agency has reported this. According to CNN, on January 16, 2023, at the Old Bailey Criminal Court in London last month, Carrick admitted to 43 charges against 11 other women, including 20 counts of rape, between March 2004 and September 2020, according to PA. A series of recent scandals has shed light on what the UK police watchdog called a culture of misogyny and racism in London's police service. The Metropolitan Police Service Commissioner Cressida Dick resigned from her post in 2022 after a damning review by the Independent Office for Police Conduct issued 15 recommendations to change policing practice in the country. London's Metropolitan Police are now investigating as many as 1,000 sex offences and domestic abuse claims involving approximately 800 of its officers, the Forces Commissioner Mark Rowley admitted recently. Rowley said in an interview with UK media, that's 1,000 cases to look at. Some of those will be things of no concern in the end when we look at them because it will be an argument overheard by neighbors where inquiries show there is nothing to be concerned about. Women's rights organizations called for an inquiry into the Met's following Carrick's case. UK domestic abuse charity Refugee called Carrick's crimes utterly abhorrent. Refugee tweeted recently, when a man who has been charged with 49 offenses, including 24 charges of rape, is a serving police officer, how can women and girls possibly be or feel safe? This is an institution in crisis. That's Carrick's pattern of egregious behavior was known to the Met, and they failed to act. It speaks more loudly than their empty promises to women. UK organization End Violence Against Women tweeted. It added, solidarity with the victims and all who are feeling the weight of the traumatic details being reported. The British Women's Equality Party tweeted, Met knew about the allegations for 20 years. They did nothing as a serial rapist abused his power. They are complicit. Misogyny will never be stripped from the police without a nationwide statutory inquiry. The Favocit Society, which campaigns for gender equality and women's rights, said on Twitter, any act of sexual violence is a disgrace, but it is particularly harmful when, yet again, these crimes have been perpetrated by a person who has additional responsibilities to keep the public safe. Along with women, the groups that have suffered the most from the British police are the black people and those with Asian origin. 1,833 police have died in police custody or following police contact in the UK since 1990, British media reported on September 27, 2022. The killing of Chris Kebbah has led to renewed calls for justice as black people continue to be disproportionately targeted by police violence. Father-to-be Chris Kebbah, 24, was unarmed when he was shot through a car windscreen in Streatham Hill on September 5, 2022 by a Met police officer. Metropolitan police officers are four times more likely to use force against black people compared with the white population, new figures suggest. The Met used force 62,000 times in 2017 to 2018, with more than a third of incidents involving black people. Techniques such as verbal instructions and using firearms are recorded. The Met police said, the proportionate use of force is essential in some circumstances to protect the public and often themselves from violence. Shadow Home Secretary Diane Abbott said, the disproportionate use of force is discriminatory.